Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the headline of the cover story, The Triangle's History of Expensive Remakes. While North Carolina braces for a $250 million shortfall in its current fiscal year budget, advocates hope to revive a law that has doled out millions of dollars in tax credits to developers refurbishing historical buildings like Durham's Imperial Tobacco Factory. And the headline and a picture of that tobacco factory is on the front page. The cover story begins inside with another headline. The high cost of preserving history. North Carolina lawmakers debate tax credits. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. For more than 15 years, the former East Durham Graded School building on Driver Street sat vacant and deteriorating, an eyesore in a neighborhood surrounded by modest homes. It was not a building high on the priority list of developers clamoring for projects that had been fueled in part by generous state historic preservation tax credits in place since 1998. The East Durham school building, though, still had good bones. When a charter school operator approached Durham's Self-Help Credit Union about renovating the building, the same historic tax credits that had helped usher an economic resurgence in downtown Durham also helped cover about $2.1 million, $1.4 million in federal and $700,000 in state credits, of the $10 million in renovation costs for what is now the Maureen Joy Charter School. That same project today, however, would have to find other sources to help keep costs in check. North Carolina's historic preservation tax credit policy was allowed to sunset without renewal by state legislators on January 1, fueling a debate statewide over the perceived fairness and need for special state tax credit programs. Some Republican lawmakers have objected to the historic tax credit, saying it gives unfair benefit to developers at the expense of other taxpayers. With a state facing as much as $250 million in budget shortfall, these tax credits for developers are under fire from many on Jones Street in Raleigh. Between 2007 and 2013, North Carolina allocated $106 million in state income tax breaks to property owners, developers, and investors of historic properties, or an average $15.2 million per year. Moreover, developers have garnered additional millions in federal tax credits for the same projects over the years. These tax credit-backed projects collectively represented about $840 million in qualified building improvement expenses for historic rehabilitation projects that were completed between 2007 and 2013, according to a North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources database. Supporters of the tax credit, including Republican Governor Pat McCrory, argue that the credits boost local economies and preserve a community's historic core, while also helping attract new companies and more jobs. McCrory and Susan Klutz, North Carolina's cultural secretary, have been crisscrossing the state on a tour in support of reinstating some form of the historic preservation tax credits in 2015. The North Carolina Metro Mayors Coalition has collected more than 5,000 petition signatures so far in its campaign also in support of reinstating state historic tax credits. McCrory has promised to include historic credits in his fiscal year 2015 to 2016 budget proposal and is also working to recruit House and Senate members to sponsor legislation to create a modified historic tax credit. A powerful tool. There wasn't a big political uproar in 2014 about the pending sunset of the historic tax credits, partly because many state leaders and proponents of the credits had assumed that a compromise would be reached and that the credits would be extended again, as they have every other time the law was set to expire. The House voted in 2014 to extend a reduced version of the tax credit through 2020, but the Senate went home without considering it. It's a really powerful tool that just ended overnight, says John Waracilla, a principal at Durham's Alliance Architecture, who has in recent years worked as both a designer and a developer of historic properties in downtown Durham. He has been an owner or principal investor in seven buildings and residences along Rigsby and East Chapel Hill Street in downtown Durham, projects that had a total renovation value of around $12 million. Waracilla says, He is conservative in his approach to development projects and likely would not have tackled them if tax credits were required to make it profitable. But he says he's had several clients on the design side who would not have been able to qualify for a construction loan without the tax credits. It was short-sighted of the state to get rid of it, he says. A matter of tax policy. The historic tax credits, and just about every other specialized tax credit program in the general statutes for film production, job creation, research and development, and business expenses for machinery and equipment, has in recent years become a punching bag among many lawmakers who instead have championed for lower tax rates for corporations and individuals across the board. There is no justification for compelling state taxpayers to subsidize the preservation of historic properties in particular cities and towns, says Sarah Curry, director of fiscal policy studies for the conservative-leaning John Locke Foundation, in a recent report opposing the historic tax credit renewal. The purpose of the tax code should be to raise revenue for core government services. It should not be used as a means to redistribute income, favor certain personal behaviors, or discourage others, or force taxpayers to be in the economic development game. The credits for income-producing properties amount to a discount on income taxes equal to about 20% of the cost of renovation, in addition to a 20% federal historic tax credit on the same expenses. To qualify as a historic building, it must have been built before 1936, listed in the National Registry of Historic Places, or located in a registered historic district. So for a $10 million renovation or rehabilitation project, an owner could qualify for as much as $4 million in state and federal historic tax credits. Credits for sale. North Carolina's expired law had also offered a tax credit on historic rehabilitation of non-income producing properties, such as a personal residence, on 30% of expenses. Savvy developers learned how to tap into a market to sell those future tax credits to an accredited investor, such as a bank or pension fund, like public stock to help finance the project. On the Maureen Joy Charter School project in Durham, self-help was able to close a $2.1 million construction budget gap by selling the anticipated federal and state historic tax credits to CAHEC, a Raleigh-based syndicator that purchased the credits on behalf of BB&T Bank at a rate of about 50 to 65 cents on the dollar. Tucker Bartlett, Executive Vice President of Self-Help Ventures Fund, says the lack of a state historic tax credit also puts North Carolina building projects at a disadvantage to more than 30 other states that still offer credits. The investors we bring into our projects are usually large banks, Bank of America, Chase, U.S. Bank, that could go into North Carolina where only the federal credits are offered, or go to Virginia where they do have state credits and can get more bank for their buck, Bartlett says. Plus, he says, some historic building projects would economically make more sense to tear down and build new without the tax credits versus modernizing the building to current building codes while still adhering to the federal government's strict rules for what qualifies and what doesn't qualify for historic rehabilitation. You can certainly build cheaper by the highway, but you end up with its generica, Bartlett says. People have an emotional connection with history, and they feel it in historic buildings. This is a product that differentiates us from every other state out there. Alternative proposals. Details of a new McCrory historic tax credit plan have not been disclosed, but options under discussion include reducing the tax credit percentage from 20% over 5 years to a 15% credit that can be claimed in year one after the building project is finished. Other groups have suggested creating a state-funded grant program to which developers of historic preservation projects could apply, particularly from areas in distressed parts of the state. A House bill co-sponsored by Representatives Susie Hamilton of Wilmington, Rodney Moore of Charlotte, and Edward Haynes of Winston-Salem has been submitted that would extend the historic tax credits and several other tax credit programs that expired in 2014 through 2020. These programs and incentives save fragile infrastructure, revitalize urban centers, and enhance overall public safety, Representative Haynes says. If all you have around you is abandoned buildings, that is a pretty tough sell for businesses to come into your community. And along with this cover story, there are a number of graphs. The first one, headlined Credit Takers, Top North Carolina Winners. Taxpayers that claimed the most historic preservation tax credits in North Carolina from 2010 to 2013. United Parcel Service, UPS, $3,126,218. Bank of America, $3,104,268. The Sherwin-Williams Company, $2,363,465. BB&T, $1,983,084. Measurement Incorporated, $1,187,682. First Bank, $694,766. Schneider Electric USA, $592,424. Clayton P. Ludman, $422,049. Stephen A. Say, $420,305. And Mark D. Beck, $285,584. And also another section lists the largest historic rehabilitation tax credit projects in the Triangle since 1998. American Tobacco Company in Durham, Liggett and Myers Tobacco Company in Durham, Bull Durham Factory and Noel Building in Durham, Liggett Myers Tobacco Company in Durham, Golden Belt Center in Durham, American Tobacco North Parcel, also in Durham, Venable Tobacco Company Warehouse in Durham, Carolee Mills in Raleigh, Pilot Mills in Raleigh, and American Tobacco Lucky Strike Building in Durham. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The first headline, Noise, It's What We Asked For. In the growing Raleigh debate about whether or not an increasing volume of noise among the Fayetteville Street District's downtown bars and restaurants are driving away residents, Raleigh restaurateur Ashley Christensen waves them off. I think we have vibrancy, I think we have energy, and I think we have just what we asked for, Christensen said at a TBJ event February 12 at her Fox Liquor Bar, one block off Fayetteville Street. Christensen, winner of TBJ's Business Person of the Year Award, currently owns and operates four restaurants and one bar in downtown Raleigh, including Pool's Diner, Jewel Coffee, Chuck's Burgers and Fries, and Beasley's Chicken and Honey. While none would be considered loud, they do often attract a late-night crowd that filters onto sidewalks and nearby streets. As a board member with Downtown Raleigh Alliance, Christensen says she's heard concerns about livability standards in downtown from area business owners and residents as construction of new buildings and redevelopment of old buildings has brought more people and more entertainment options into the district. Christensen was careful not to point fingers, but she did discredit those who have tried to claim that the city is in decline due to the increasing number of bars in the area. Everyone is entitled to decide where to live and what to be upset about, frankly, she said. For someone who travels to a lot of cities, I'll tell you what, when you walk down the streets the next morning in a lot of those cities, Raleigh is an absolute picnic. A workforce that reads together. Roe, spelled R-H-O, co-CEOs Laura Helms-Reese and Russ Helms, launched a company-wide book club and say employees want to participate at a higher rate than even they anticipated. They chose Brain Rules, 12 Principles for Surviving and Thriving at Work, Home, and School, which Helm says was sort of an obvious first choice for us. The company bought the book for all employees and invited them to a discussion, much like any book club among friends. We actually had a whole lot more participation than we anticipated, Helm says. He jokes that there was more participation from the departments with extroverted personalities and relatively few people from the more introverted sections of our company. Next, the club will tackle the happiness advantage, the 7 principles of positive psychology that fuel success and performance at work, written by Sean Aker, an advocate for positive psychology. Roe currently has 367 employees. Last year, they hired 61 new employees. A Beer Divided captures Duke-UNC rivalry. Top of the Hill in Chapel Hill and Triangle Brewing Company in Durham are brewing a collaboration beer that celebrates the Duke-UNC rivalry. The result is A Beer Divided, an American Pale Ale with 5.5% ABV. The beer will be released a few days before the second Duke versus UNC game on March 7 at each brewery's pub, as well as several Durham and Chapel Hill bars. We have a friendly wager on the outcome of the second game, says Chris Atkins of Top of the Hill. If Duke wins, the brewers from Top of the Hill will guest bartend at Triangle's Pint and Plate in Duke clothing, and vice versa if Carolina wins. Mayor Bill Bell of Durham and Mayor Mark Kleinschmidt of Chapel Hill even stopped by to help with the brew. And the tweet of the week from Snow Day, February 17. I think I'm the only legislator in the building. Let me take care of a few things. Medicaid equals expanded. Teachers equals paid. Film equals jobs. Hashtag NCGA. That's from North Carolina State Senator Jeff Jackson. And now we turn to the reporter pages inside the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the page for Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. The main headline, sold, $127 million sale of Lenovo campus in RTP. Sale yields $100 million more than its 2013 purchase price. The real estate stars have aligned again for the joint venture partnership between Rubenstein Partners and Grubb Properties after the sale of the two newly renovated Lenovo office buildings in Research Triangle Park in a deal valued at $127 million. The partnership paid only $26 million for the property in December 2013 after the building sat vacant for 3 years. Less than 6 weeks after its 2013 purchase, Lenovo leased the entire 445,584 square foot campus, a deal that ranked as the largest office lease deal in the Triangle in 2014, valued at $121 million over the term of the contract. Final contracts for the sale of the 7001 and 8001 Development Drive buildings were signed February 13, according to county records. The buyer for the property is a London-based real estate investment group, 90 North Real Estate Partners. Last fall, 90 North established its first office in North America with the intention of making investments of about $750 million over the next 18 to 24 months, according to reports. In that time, 90 North has acquired two other properties in Chicago and in Denver, but the RTP buildings are, so far, its largest real estate investment in the U.S. Cabela's announces opening date. Hunting, fishing, and outdoor gear giant Cabela's has announced that it will be opening its newest store location in Garner, the first in North Carolina, on April 16, with a week of activities and events that are still being planned. Anticipation for the 105,000-square-foot Cabela's store, the anchor retailer in the White Oak Crossing Shopping Center at the intersection of I-40 and U.S. 70 in Garner, has been building since the Nebraska company announced in fall 2013 that it picked the site. Cabela's competitors, including a Bass Pro Shops, Field & Stream, and Gander Mountain, have also opened new stores in the Triangle region since Cabela's broke ground in Garner. Doors will open April 16 at 10 a.m., following a ribbon-cutting ceremony with Cabela's executives and local town officials. Cafe Press sells Raleigh-based art division. Custom t-shirt, poster, and art producer Cafe Press will sell its Raleigh-based art division to Colorado-based Circle Graphics. The deal, expected to be finalized by the end of March, includes more than 1.5 million images from the art division's library at the Raleigh facility. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. Circle Graphics intends to hire all 180 employees in the division and keep open its 60,000-square-foot production facility near Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Triangle Rent-A-Car sold to Enterprise. Triangle Rent-A-Car, the Raleigh-based rental car company, has been sold to its biggest national competitor, Enterprise Holdings. Terms weren't disclosed, but Enterprise execs say the goal is to retain the 300 full and part-time employees at Triangle Rent-A-Car's 29 branch offices in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and Georgia. Frank Colonna, president of Triangle Rent-A-Car, founded the company in 1979. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the page for reporter Jason DeBruin, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. His main articles headlined, Sprout resubmits to FDA. Raleigh company's drug targets female sexual dysfunction. Sprout Pharmaceuticals resubmitted its application for approval of the first ever treatment to stimulate sexual desire in women. Hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, is the most commonly reported form of female sexual dysfunction. HSDD has been medically recognized for more than 30 years. It is defined as a persistent or recurrent deficiency or absence of sexual fantasies and desire for sexual activity that causes marked distress or interpersonal difficulty. Sprout's experimental drug called flibanserin would be the first and only approved drug to treat a female sexual disorder. There are 26 approved drugs for male sexual disorders. The new drug application submission made February 17 to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration isn't the first time flibanserin will go before federal regulators. In the summer of 2013, Sprout first sought FDA approval, but the agency denied the application. Later that year, Sprout filed a formal appeal and announced last February that the FDA gave guidance on what additional tests would be required before submitting a new application. Since then, CEO Cindy Whitehead convinced investors to believe in the investigational drug and raised $15 million for additional tests. In total, Sprout has raised $50 million to develop flibanserin, all from private investors, a rarity in a world where drug companies look for venture funds or the public markets for dollar amounts of that size. Sprout has now tested the drug in more than 11,000 women. This NDA resubmission marks the completion of the additional clinical studies requested by FDA, says Whitehead. The FDA has devoted significant resources to understand HSDD and the need for medical treatment. I believe that the agency's efforts to bring together panels of patients and clinical experts will prove to be a significant step in bringing about a solution for women with HSDD to market. This year, I am optimistic that women and their partners affected by the life impact of HSDD will have their first potential medical solution. GSK replaces Connolly, RTPS Bailey to take over. Deidre Connolly, the highest-ranking GlaxoSmithKline employee in North America, has been replaced by the London-based drug giant. Jack Bailey, the Senior Vice President for Policy, Payers, and Vaccines, who works from the company's Research Triangle Park offices, will replace the 54-year-old Connolly. He joined Glaxo in 2009 and was most recently responsible for government affairs, managed markets, and the U.S. Vaccines Business Unit, as well as the company's Puerto Rico operations. Pharmaceutical sales in the United States dropped off for GSK in 2014, particularly as the asthma drug Advair declined. Insurance carriers negotiated lower reimbursement rates for some of Advair's competitors and began to put those drugs in pricing categories that would come with lower copays for consumers, driving business away from GSK. Healthcare spending once again on the rise. Total healthcare spending in the United States surpassed $3 trillion last year and now makes up 17.8% of total GDP. Healthcare spending as a share of GDP had fallen below the 2011 high watermark, but surpassed that last year. Health spending by category, hospital 32%, physician clinical 19%, prescription drugs 10%, dental services 4%, nursing care 5%, home health 3%, remaining personal health 11%, and other 16%. And finally, under a section headlined Plant Closure, $45 million. How much it will cost drug maker Hospira to close its Clayton plant, a move that will affect 250 workers. Part of the cost will include $15 million in employee-related costs, including severance. Hospira announced the plant closing in mid-January and reported further detail in the company's quarterly filings on February 12. In the meantime, drug giant Pfizer announced plans to acquire Hospira for $90 per share, or an enterprise value of $17 billion. Pfizer already employs 630 workers in North Carolina, including 400 at a site in Stanford. Hospira employs nearly 3,000 in North Carolina, mostly at a facility in Rocky Mount. And now we turn to the reporter page of Lauren Onosorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. The first headline, Nimble Storage Double Downs at RTP Facility. A month into its new lease at Swabia Court in Durham, Silicon Valley-based internet storage firm Nimble Storage has decided to take over the entire building. The company moved into its new Triangle Digs January 9, initially planning to take over half of the 87,000-square-foot building. But according to Hashish Prakash, senior director of research Triangle Park operations for the firm, the company changed its mind, signing a deferred lease for the rest of the structure. That means Nimble will start leasing the other half next year. Nimble is committing to this area in a big way, he says, adding that the 7-year lease term ensures the firm will stick around. At the rate we've grown in the last 2 years, I think we'll be expanding into the other side in the next couple of years. As executives were looking at the growth trajectory, they wanted to go ahead and stake claim to the space so as not to split their headcount down the line, he says. The old space at 15,000 square feet was just to get something started, he says. And the new space reflects the open culture, he adds, with glass and openness. An outdoor courtyard has been fitted with Wi-Fi, meaning employees currently working out of the space can enjoy the sunshine. Already 95 people work at Nimble in the Triangle. Prakash says the expectation was to be at about 70 or 80 people by this point. The side of the building the company is currently leasing can hold about 135 people, he says, including a training lab and a break room. Customer support, sales, and product development are the primary functions of the space, and all are growing, he says. Over the course of the year, general administration functions, too, will be moving into the space, including some finance and accounting. Part of the goal for this site was to act as a base for East Coast operations and supporting the field, so we have a training facility we can bring partners and customers into, Prakash says. The new location is at Newcastle South at 1015 Swabia Court in Durham. Nimble Storage, which competes with RTP giants NetApp and EMC, both for customers and new employees, continues to hire. Deal could bring more VC to NC. Tech firm investors get a nice exit. A little more than 8 years ago, first-time entrepreneur Robbie Allen took the plunge founding StatSheet, which later became Automated Insights. This month, Allen confirmed via blog post that Automated Insights was acquired by Vista Equity Partners-owned Stats, a deal that Allen's first investor, IDEA, Idea Fund Partners Lister Delgado, says makes investors very happy, although specifics weren't disclosed. It's the latest good news for Allen, who started the 30-worker firm while working at Cisco. Allen has come a long way since then, moving into Diamond View 1 over the Durham Bulls Athletic Park last year and raising more than $10 million in equity financing from backers such as Osage Partners, Court Square Ventures, OCA Ventures, Idea Fund Partners, Associated Press, Revolution Ventures, Box Group, and Samsung Open Innovation. His technology, which translates pages upon pages of big data into thousands of stories per day, the tech dubbed Wordsmith generated about 1 billion stories in 2014, caught AOL founder Steve Case's attention last year. The tech entrepreneur turned venture capitalist invested $100,000 in Automated Insights, and fellow Durham startup Windsor Circle after seeing the team's representations at Google for entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. Delgado calls the deal bittersweet. I do believe the company has a lot more to give to the world. It is just that it will happen with other investors, he says, adding that Automated Insights didn't go out looking for an exit, but the offer, which has not been disclosed, was too good to pass up, he explains. Every single investor is very, very happy, and not only every investor, but every employee. And Robbie is pretty happy too. We would not have done this deal if it was not a very, very nice deal, he says. It's great to give these out-of-town investors a nice exit. It tells them, I can do it again in North Carolina. And in a by-the-numbers section, the number is 40%. That's how many Cisco employees have been realigned to high-priority areas, according to Cisco CEO John Chambers, who told investors via recent earnings call that more than 30% of our leaders had been replaced. It's an update on a bullish restructuring strategy that cost 225 Research Triangle Park employees their jobs last year. Most companies resist changing until it's too late and their market credibility is eroded. The classic innovator's dilemma, he says, adding that Cisco tried to undercut that trend by voluntarily reorganizing early. We are seeing the results of, and our relevancy with our customers and our operational excellence, and that is driving our financial performance. Total revenue increased 7% in its most recent quarter to $11.94 billion, with net income rising 68% to $2.4 billion. Analysts expected revenue of about $11.8 billion. Accelerator to have rent-free use of Cary Theater. A new entrepreneurship space in Cary is about to open its doors to entrepreneurs. David Gardner, one of three investors turning a Cary-owned space on Chatham Street into an accelerator, says that while the effort doesn't yet have a name, the plan is coming together. Entrepreneurs could be in the space by March, he says. Gardner, along with fellow angel investors Alex Osedzinski and Whitney Rowe, worked out a rent-free arrangement with the town to use the third floor of a space connected to the old Cary Theater. It's basically a row of tables, Gardner says, comparing the space to the startup factory at American Tobacco Campus in Durham. Think an open space with phone booths for private calls. But while some accelerators are product-focused, he gives Raleigh's Citrix Accelerator as one example, this effort will be business-focused, he says. Already signed up for the space is Oak City Engineering, a company that works on software prototypes for startups. Its small team of developers will be working with companies to develop their products, while Gardner and his team will have their hands on the business plans. It's going to be a make-it-or-get-out kind of deal, Gardner says. If people come in and they present to us and we think what they're doing has legs, we'll get involved with them and start entrepreneuring with them. Gardner says to expect a very hands-on approach. My model is to give them a bunch of homework and see how they execute on it, he says. Basically, they're going to get going and we're going to fund them, or they're going to move out and make room. He calls the concept a testing ground and one that will be well monitored, as the investors' offices will be on the other side of a glass wall. One thing that is still in flux, the name, while a planned venture capital fund the trio are working on will be called Co-Founders Capital, no name has been given to the effort on Chatham Street. It should have Cary in it, Gardner says. And now we turn to the A Better World page, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Project Battles Human Trafficking. In 2011, when Salvation Army of Wake County launched a program to rescue foreign-born victims of human trafficking, it served 12 individuals in its first 3 months, a number it had expected to serve in its first 2 years. So it expanded the project, known as Project Fight, to include clients born in the U.S., and now has served 207 individuals, including victims and their family members. It also has trained more than 4,500 people across the state to help identify individuals caught in the web of human trafficking and raise awareness about the issue. Now, with a 2-year, $458,000 federal grant, the Salvation Army is expanding the program to New Bern and Salisbury. It's modern-day slavery, which a lot of people don't realize still exists, says Christine Shaw, Director of Social Ministries at Salvation Army of Wake County. Wake's Salvation Army first got involved in statewide anti-trafficking efforts in 2005. Foreign-born victims, many of them from Latin America, South America, and Asia, often arrive in the U.S. believing they are coming legally, she says. Their families often pay for their travel, and they believe they are coming to work in a hotel or restaurant or as a nanny, for example. But once in the U.S., many victims are put into organized brothel rings that may move them frequently up and down the East Coast. They are cut off from their families and threatened that if they don't do what they are told and pay off what they are told is their debt, their families will be hurt, and room and board are deducted from whatever pay they may receive. Victims born in the U.S. often are befriended by someone who becomes a boyfriend before making the relationship commercial. Most cases, especially in the Triangle, involve forced or coerced prostitution or pornography, Shaw says. Some cases involve labor trafficking. Project Fight partners with 150 groups, such as hospitals, clinics, domestic violence shelters, and agencies that focus on law enforcement, legal services, job readiness, and emergency assistance for clothing, food, and housing. For foreign-born victims, Project Fight works to get their documentation for residency. Working with the North Carolina Coalition Against Human Trafficking, Wake Salvation Army is part of an effort to create teams of professionals across the state that can respond within 24 hours after a victim is found. With an annual budget of $350,000 and a staff that will grow to 5 people from 3, Project Fight raises money through grants, contributions, and an annual event, Just Art, a project of Red Light Film and Art, a nonprofit arm of Ecclesia, a Raleigh church. In 2014, Project Fight served 66 victims and likely will serve 75 this year. About one-fourth of its cases involve minors, 37% are ages 18 to 25, and most victims trapped in commercial sex trafficking begin at ages 12 to 14, Shaw says. What is driving human trafficking, she says, is the demand for cheap labor and commercial sex. MIMS promotes water conservation. MIMS Distributing Company, a North Carolina wholesale beverage distributor, partnered with Triangle Delta Waterfowl for its banquet to raise awareness of the importance of environmental conservation. In 2011, MIMS moved to a newly renovated facility, which includes one of the largest private solar rooftops in Wake County and bioretention ponds to minimize on-site water consumption. MIMS Distributing places a premium on water conservation and the future of waterfowl and waterfowl hunting, as water is a necessity to the successful production of beers and wines. Parker Poe donates computers to Ligon. Raleigh law firm Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein donated 30 computers to Ligon GT Magnet Middle School. The computers have replaced 30 older workstations in Ligon's Media Center that were unable to upgrade to Windows 7. Computers in the Media Center are in constant use throughout the day by students working on school-related assignments. Having newer, faster machines allows them to gather information and complete work more efficiently, giving more students the opportunity to use the computers as a resource. In 2014, the firm also donated 30 computers to William G. Enloe High School, another Wake County public school. And now we turn to the Executive Voice column in the Triangle Business Journal. And the focus is on Glenn White. And his company is Complete Construction Company Incorporated. He is the president. There are 4 employees. It was founded in 1983. He is age 55. He has 3 daughters. His education, high school, and his first job was a paper route. And this column is a question and an answer written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. The headline, From Remodeling to Role Modeling. For the first time in 14 years, a professional from the Triangle's home remodeling industry has taken the helm of the Home Builders Association of Raleigh-Wake County, a position traditionally held by an owner or executive from a new home building company in the region. Glenn White, president of Complete Construction Incorporated in Apex, began his career as a new home builder. He even took home a few Parade of Home awards. But in the late 1990s, he shifted his focus to a niche market, home renovations, and he's never looked back. He was named the Association's Remodeler of the Year in 2006 and 2010, and the overall HBA Builder of the Year in 2010. Now he helms the largest local home builder association in the U.S., bigger even than those in Charlotte, Atlanta, and Houston, with a membership roster of more than 3,000. What do you see as your role in this transition this year? Thanks to the past leadership and staff, we have managed to thrive through the past difficult times, but I believe we need to now prepare for a more robust future. After having had the chance to see other HBAs across the country, I can now see how and why this is not just the largest, but I humbly believe the best local HBA in the country, and my hope is to keep that progressive vision. How have you seen the remodeling industry in the Triangle change over the past 7 years since the start of the Great Recession? Was there a spike in competition? Absolutely. It came directly from the new construction sector. The business models, new versus renovation, are just so different. There were challenges with both builder and customer education. The new construction builders either finally adjusted their models or just refrained from renovation work altogether. Either way, many projects for remodelers were lost to best intention but underpriced builders who were in survival mode. Do things seem to be returning to normal in the Triangle home building industry? Not sure we will return to the volume of pre-recession discretionary and high-end projects anytime soon, but I do see that mainstream optimism has returned. From a pure numbers perspective, Wake County is about 70% back from pre-recession volumes. What do you see as the biggest challenges facing the home building industry in 2015 and into 2016? Easy. The biggest challenges for our market over the next few years are lot availability, labor shortage, and local governments in regards to approval of new subdivisions. You mentioned in your address at your installation as HBA president in December that you'd like to create a new young professional committee within the association. What do you hope to accomplish through this group? There is an incredible source of available young talent within this membership. I also know there are times when people develop experiences in upper levels of an organization that it becomes easier to lose sight of some of the basic fundamentals that got them there. The initial guidance that was given to me that aided my progression to leadership roles over the years has been invaluable. There's always something very rewarding in passing that along to the next generation of leadership. So how do we not only locate but also inform and educate them to all the opportunities that will help and be successful? I believe a good starting place would be to create an environment made up of young professionals to help that happen. How would you describe your management style? I work hard at looking past personalities for the individual's specific talents and arranging tasks from that perspective. I think we all have our distinct forms of talent. What do you look for in a person when hiring a new employee or a tradesman? Renovation is a service more than a product, so I would place quality people skills as absolutely essential. How did you first get involved in this industry and later climb the ladder to start your own company? I think carpentry is in my DNA, from shop classes in elementary and high school to working my way up through the trades, framing to finished carpentry to subcontractor to licensed contractor. What did you want to be when you grew up? Not sure I was driven to a particular career, just wanted the ability to chart my own course. What are your hobbies now? Woodworking and scuba. What's your favorite tool in your toolbox and why? My construction master calculator. I find some sense of joy in the planning and calculating of what I'm about to build. What does your kitchen and bathroom look like at home? Too funny. My kitchen is in the process of remodeling. Know any good contractors? And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the small business section and the In the Workplace column that today is written by Edward Marshall. Dr. Edward Marshall works with senior teams and companies to build high trust, collaborative leadership, cultures, and practices. He is author of the best-selling Building Trust at the Speed of Change. The headline on his column, What Trust Really Means for Business Owners. I have the distinct honor to have recently been given a Lifetime Achievement Award as a Trust Thought Leader by Trust Across America, TAA, a nonprofit that focuses on the importance of trustworthy business. I am dedicating this award to the millions of people who go to work each day trying to help their businesses be successful, even though many of them live in cultures of distrust and fear. In spite of difficult work environments, our workforces press on with committed efforts to do the best they can. It is in their struggle for trust in the workplace that has been where I have received a lifetime of learning. My life's work, focused on building trust through collaboration, has been one way to acknowledge these efforts and their hopes for a new way of working. TAA publishes an online magazine called Trust, which just published its winter 2015 issue that focuses on top trust thought leaders across the country and their perspectives on trust and trustworthy business. Here is the piece I wrote for this issue. Lei Su once said of trust, "Those who are trustworthy, he trusts, and those who are not trustworthy, he also trusts. In this way, he gets their trust." We live in a time of great distrust, not only of civil, political, and economic institutions, but also of each other, and even our prospects for the future. We yearn for relationships and organizations that operate with integrity, honor, transparency, and grace. It is possible. Trust is the core of our very existence, and it starts within each of us, our character, values, beliefs, and actions toward others. As a gift to others, even those not trustworthy, our own trustworthiness can be the pebble in the pond that ripples across our society. To paraphrase Gandhi, we need to be the trust we want to see. The trust challenges we face are to create family and work cultures based on the principles of dignity, respect, and integrity to address the root causes of distrust wherever it exists, and to work collectively to solve the most pressing problems of our world. It starts with us, inside out. My best wishes to all of us who are on this journey. And in the People on the Move section in the Triangle Business Journal, the spotlight is on Gavin Nichols, President of Technology, Head of Software Business Unit, Carry Office Leader at Certara. Former Quintiles exec Gavin Nichols now has the responsibility of heading drug development consultancy Certara's Carry Office, its only location in the Triangle. His role is threefold. One, as President of Technology, he works alongside Certara's Chief Scientific Officer to align and integrate all of the company's technology elements. Two, as head of Certara's Software Business Unit, where he serves as General Manager and works to build on past successes. And three, as site head for Certara's offices in Cary, where his primary goals are to ensure that the company maintains what he calls a happy and productive group in the Triangle and works to build and develop strong relationships with partners. St. Louis-based Certara employs a total of 300 people, 30 of whom are in its Cary location. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? That Certara, which was created through the acquisition of five companies, Farsight, Simsip, Tribos, Synchrogenics, and Clingenuity, has even more potential than its constituent parts. What are some of your major goals for your new role at Certara? One of my major goals, together with our Chief Marketing Officer, is to get the Certara name out to the industry and into the C-suite where our value proposition really resonates. I also want to establish additional strategic partnerships with universities, pharmaceutical companies, consortia, technology vendors, and potentially even CROs. What's your biggest pet peeve? People who believe playing corporate politics is a successful career. What's your biggest worry? That we, life sciences executives, don't realize the potential of some of the new capabilities and approaches that have been developed, and in doing so won't translate those advances into meaningful improvements for patients who are suffering around the world every day. Triangle area business person you most admire? What I most admire is Quintiles Executive Chairman Dennis Gillings. Personal, wife Deborah, children, Samantha and Jamie. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we will read the guest column. And this guest column is written by J. Richard Leonard, who is the Dean of the Campbell University School of Law in Raleigh. The headline on the column, his opinion, Why Campbell Law Bucked National Trend. December 15 of each year is a critical date for law schools. That is the date on which all of the hype and obfuscation give way to harsh reality as we report our data about our incoming class, the number, demographics, and qualifications of the students who joined us in the fall. The reporting this year was followed immediately by national headlines heralding the declining interest in law school. The ABA Journal reported that nationally, first-year enrollment dropped to the lowest point since 1973. The Wall Street Journal reported that the trend is continuing into 2015, with the applicant pool down another 8.5%. Ominously, TaxProf blog reported that 80 law schools are at risk of closure. At Campbell Law, we were delighted to welcome 185 new students last fall, a 48% increase over the 125 who matriculated 1 year earlier. This was the largest percentage increase reported by any of the 203 accredited law schools. Moreover, many of our competitors only seeded a class by dramatically dropping admission standards. We did not. The profile of our 2014 entering class matched almost precisely that of the prior year, with only a 1-point drop in the LSAT average of the bottom quarter. This was part of a deliberate strategy that matched a careful plan, but the truth of the matter is we were stunned, although delighted, by our success. Yet there are some things that clearly contribute. First and foremost is our location. Raleigh is one of the fastest growing and most vibrant cities in America and the world, and we have done a good job telling that story. In fact, when we poll our students about why they chose us, 60% list location as the most important factor. And thanks largely to my savvy predecessor, Melissa Essery, who engineered the move to Raleigh and oversaw the design of our building. It turns out that students enroll in law school to become lawyers. Over the last 25 years, we have had the highest North Carolina bar passage rate, a stat that is not lost on our applicants. We were able to do this because we are a community of extraordinary teachers. I read thousands of student evaluations each semester and am always reinforced by the accolades our students give to their professors. We do research, we write, we perform community service, but first and foremost, we teach. With one of the lowest faculty-student ratios in the nation, small classes and intense personal attention are the norm. We also change some things. We altered our scholarship policies to make us more attractive to honorably discharged veterans and to undergraduates at our main campus. We created full tuition merit scholarships in advocacy, leadership, and public service to attract the most talented students. We created a novel flex program to allow established professionals in the community to return to law school on a part-time basis without giving up their current careers. Finally, we benefit from the way in which legal education has circled back to where Campbell Law has always been. We have been turning out well-trained, practice-ready lawyers for more than 3 decades. We are confident that this training is equally valuable for the increasing number of our graduates who hope to use their degrees for other than a traditional career. Underlying these sharp skills is the faith-based view we all share that law is a moral commitment to serve justice, not just a way to make a living. As we examine these indicators of our success, we can better understand the benefits that our graduates offer us. As a relatively young law school, our alumni are just now reaching the highest ranks of our profession. We will install our first graduate to serve as president of the North Carolina Bar Association, Shelby Benton, next summer. But already, 77 Campbell Law graduates are sitting judges in federal and state courts at trial and appellate levels. They appreciate the education they received here and are steering the next generation our way. We are not seers and have no more idea than anyone else how the role of lawyers will change, but we are approaching the future nimbly and with eyes open. We are confident that our best days are ahead and that this city and region will be increasingly proud to have Campbell Law as part of its identity and purpose. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have another guest opinion. This one's written by Anthony Tata, a published author and the secretary of the for the North Carolina Department of Transportation. The headline on his opinion, his viewpoint, authors, leaders have many similarities. I often get asked how I write novels such as my upcoming release from Kensington Books Pinnacle, Foreign and Domestic. Writing a book is not unlike running a business. In the corporate world, there is often tension between creativity and organization. We've all seen the genius strategic planner with the desk piled high full of papers. She's brilliant, but not organized. Then there is the hyper-left-brained accountant whose mind and file cabinets have everything neatly arranged by crosstabs. He's organized, but struggles with understanding his role in the bigger picture. Put these two together under the right leadership, and you've got dynamic tension that creates great results. Writing, like leading an organization, is about finding that balance between structure and vision. There are two basic approaches authors take when writing a novel. A writer can begin with the idea and write, letting the characters take the author where they want to go. Conversely, some novelists create detailed 40-page outlines, and the book becomes an expansion of the outline. Of course, every author is different. I use a hybrid method. I usually start with an idea, write a few chapters, ensuring my protagonist is likable, but not formulaic, and that my antagonist is complex, perhaps even likable, and knows my hero's Achilles heel. Once I've got that down, I'll stop and put in across the top of an Excel spreadsheet about 10 key things that need to happen in the book. Then I'll line up my characters along the left side of the spreadsheet. In the body of the spreadsheet, I will use a few words to describe the action that the character will perform to achieve the objective of that scene or chapter. I'll also include the reaction of the opposing character, which ensures conflict. Some of the organizing items along the top columns are the stakes, the hero's goal, the bad guy's goal, in direct opposition to the hero's, love interest introduced, the antagonist gets encircled, the hero has no chance, reflection, and of course, goal accomplishment or not. In a thriller novel, something big must be clearly at stake. Someone must be dead set on my hero not achieving his goal. Not surprisingly, the organizing method I use to write novels is very similar to how I planned the invasion of small countries when I was the war plans officer for the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg. The well-known action-reaction-counter-reaction method of plotting served me well then and is useful as an author. Writing like leading is all about finding that balance between creativity and structure. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.